you not want to read a book of essays with titles like Am I Jewish Enough? And If My Dad Could Tweet? Delia Efron joins us to talk about her new collection.
I was just so lost, and I began to write about what the sisterhood of it really, our sisterhood, and what that means and how complicated that is.
Could the biggest nuclear risk be the result of an accident? Eric Schlosser, author of Fast Food Nation, joins us to talk about Command and Control, his new book about nuclear accidents and national security.
I don't believe that we're doomed, but I think of all the national security issues we should be discussing, nuclear weapons is at the top.
And Greg Coles will have bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For every audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview.
Delia Efron joins us to talk about her new collection of essays, Sister, Mother, Husband, Dog. Hi, Delia.
Hi. How are you?
Good, good. So I was just looking over the table of contents, and I love the titles of some of these essays that you've written, and I'm going to just ask you straight out about them based on their titles alone. Am I Jewish Enough?
I have to tell you that my father, every night at dinner, if I said something funny, he didn't just say, that's a great line, write it down. He often said, that's a great title, write it down. So I had titles for things before I had any idea that I would even be a writer. And I think I always get an idea for something with a title first, thanks to my dad. And Am I Jewish Enough came to me because I was on the Jewish book circuit. And everywhere I went, they kept asking me questions about being Jewish. And I had never even really thought about it.
You couldn't answer any of the questions.
No, I couldn't answer them. What kind of a Jew are you? And they would say, are you a food Jew? And then I would start asking all my friends, what kind of Jew are you? And then they would all say, and no one ever writes about this because it's like this thing that is just too thing to write about. And someone said to me, we used to call ourselves show business Jews. We used to call ourselves comedy Jews. I mean, there were all these different answers everyone had. And so I really had to write about what it meant to be Jewish.
See, I'm so ignorant. I thought it was that it was a conservative versus reform versus Orthodox kind of question.
But it's really, what, am I Jewish enough for the JBC, which is because they're always asking you, are there Jewish characters in your books? And I'd have to say no, but sometimes there were none in The Lion Is In, which is what I was touring for. And I felt, and I knew, okay, one less book sold. Which is, you know, very depressing.
Do you feel like you're not Jewish enough?
For the JBC, for sure, but I'm Jewish enough for my husband, which is all that matters.
Well, he, of course, is also a big subject of the book. But before we go on to him, did you belong to the show business Jews or the food Jews, or did you?
We were show business Jews, but we were not food Jews. We were book Jews, I thought, which is that we just worship books, and they were in the house everywhere, and I guess that's what it was. But I had also converted twice by accident, so I had many adventures in religion, and I wanted to write about them.
Wait, you converted twice by accident?
Yes. Once I was at a Billy Graham rally when I was in high school, and at the Los Angeles Coliseum. And
just for kicks?
Sort of. I had seen Elmer Gantry, and I was really curious. I thought maybe people would be having religious faints and everything. And they said, if you believe, come down here. And we couldn't really see him. We were way up in the stands. So we went down. And then when we got to the bottom, they said, now that you've given yourself to Christ. And I almost fainted, of course. And it was one of those things where you pull off a goof and realize you've just gone way too far, which, you know, I did as a teenager. So I then got grabbed by a Billy Graham representative, and he started me on my new life. He gave me a book with fill in the blank, you know. What was the first question? Who have sinned? And he helped me with that. I had to fill in all have sinned. So that was my first adventure. And then the second time my godson was being baptized, and I had never been in a situation like that. And the right in the middle of the thing, you know, the minister said to my husband and me, will you turn to Jesus Christ and accept him as your savior? And I'm like, you know, no.
So it's putting you on the spot a little.
Fortunately, you know, my godson Teddy started screaming like crazy. And so I was supposed to say, I do. And I said, I do not. Just the littlest knot that almost no one could hear except my husband. So, but my husband just said, I do, because he said to me, he doesn't really believe in any of this stuff. So what did it matter?
But you didn't dunk your head in water.
No, my God, no. But Teddy did.
And so you also, obviously, the title of the book is Sister, Husband, Dog, and you mentioned your husband. So tell me about what else he's done other than convert to Christianity.
Oh.
Not really.
I really write mostly about my 20s and how Seven Brides for Seven Brothers almost destroyed my life, because all I wanted was to go into the backwoods like Jane Powell did and make flapjacks and biscuits and eggs and whatever for seven brothers. And so I, of course, married the first man and asked me and avoided my destiny, I guess.
That was the first bad marriage.
And yeah, that was. And then I talk about that and how I swore off that. I got out of that, and because my husband didn't want me to be a writer. And when I asked him, I said, why? And he said, I don't want you to be famous. Suppose you become famous. So I said, I promise I won't be famous. And obviously, I had to leave him. Not for that reason.
Once you became famous.
No, just because, you know, if someone wants to crush your dreams with their big fat foot, you do have to get out of there. I at least
knew
that.
It's not a good sign in
general. And then I sort of met my husband in a very romantic comedy way, and I write all about that.
And you still regularly watch Seven Brides for Seven Brothers?
Yes, I do, and I forced my friend Joy to watch it with me last week.
How many times have you seen it?
I have no idea. Upwards of 30, for sure.
You start off the book talking about your late sister, Nora. Did you know that you wanted to write about it, or was it something that you reluctantly did? Or
I had to write about it, and it was what started the book for me. I was so upset and confused. I mean, I'm second born, and she was there from the beginning, and as you can imagine, a force from the beginning. And we were collaborators, sisters. We were children of writers who collaborated. Our lives were, you know, we borrowed lines from each other the way other people borrow dresses. And I was just so lost. And I began to write about what the sisterhood of it really, our sisterhood and what that means and how complicated that is. Because sisters aren't friends. It's a very uncivilized relationship,
right?
Being a sister. And my first memory of Nora was that she bit into a tomato in such a perfect way as to squirt juice in my eye, which is difficult to do. So I just started to write all about that, and it got me to a better place. And then I started to think about, I was on the Jewish book tour at the time, and so I started to write about being Jewish, and then I started to write about everything. So it started with Nora.
And in the essay about Nora, you started off by talking about your dog.
Yes, when I do. I mean, I was on my way to the doggy dermatologist, and of course, Nora was in my head the whole time because, well, when she'd been sick, my dog had been sick, and of course, I hadn't been paying any attention to her. And it was just, it sort of frames the piece, this trip to the vet. And it's the funniest thing about sometimes Nora's just in my head. Like, I used the word allegedly the other day, and it's one of her favorite words.
It's a very good word.
It is a good word. And I sometimes just put salt on something, and I think, oh, Nora didn't think I salted things enough. Or, I mean, there's just a way that I know everything about her. And so I'm sitting waiting for my dog to get, and I'm thinking about how Nora loved to do tree pose. And, you know, it's all about where your mind goes,
right?
when you're grieving, really.
Your dog was eating his paw?
Yeah, she was.
Her paw.
She was eating her paw. She actually is still eating her paw. She had to go on a kangaroo, an all kangaroo diet. I don't know if anyone realizes that there's kangaroo dog food.
And this was a dermatological problem?
Yeah, first of all, you know, there are specialists, there are dog specialists. So I was at a doggy dermatologist who kept saying that if this didn't work out, if she couldn't get cured from the from the kangaroo, she would have to, we would have to get all the mites out of the house. And I didn't even know there were mites in my house. And I really do not believe we have mites. I just want to say that. But I mean, there were like...
It's better mites than bed bugs.
Yeah, yeah. I guess that's really true. So, I mean, she... It was quite a bill, let me put it that way, by the time honey got out of there. And for a long time, she was just eating kangaroo, and she did get cured, but then it sort of came back.
And then another title that I love, If My Dad Could Tweet.
Oh, my gosh. My dad, he was an uproar man. Uproar was his specialty, and in that, he's very has a lot in common with people like Alec Baldwin, who are constantly pulling focus and then saying, "How did this happen? All I did was this."
Right.
You know, my
tweeting
father,
himself into trouble.
Yeah, right. And my father who lived on the telephone. In fact, he said to me, "I live half my life in the real world and half on the telephone." And I thought, "God, he is truly ahead of his time." So, it's all about if only my dad could tweet.
What would he tweet?
He was always very proud. It didn't matter what you wrote as long as you were getting attention. He was really happy. He was very proud of us. And he would have been tweeting it all. And then he would have been tweeting the sisters so that they would all get jealous of each other. He loved to stir up trouble in the family. He was loved to call up and just say things like, "Your sister won the Pulitzer," when she hadn't, you know. But it seemed like she might have.
So are you tweeting now, and will your sister
tweet
on his behalf?
I tweet. Sisters? I like tweeting. Do you tweet?
I do tweet. I do tweet. But I know that tweeting into trouble urge, and so I do the sit on the tweet before I tweet
you
it.
You have
thing.
To be very careful that you don't, like, just get angry and tweet or something.
Right, drunk tweeting.
Yeah, my father would have definitely be into that because he did have a bit of a problem in that direction.
And also your mother, about.
My mother was the – there was a thing in my family which was a sort of – in the way that famous things are in families. And it was that my mother on her deathbed said to my sister Nora, "Take notes." And everyone has always thought what a brilliant, amazing thing this was. And on her deathbed, I was about to have my first book come out, which is called – The Adventurous Crocheter. It was all about crocheting. It was a craft book. And the last words she said to me on her deathbed were, "I hated crocheting." Okay.
Oh, God.
All right. So my whole life I've heard this, you know, take notes thing. And I've always thought it was an extremely strange thing to say. I mean, if you think about it as a mother, you're dying and your daughter or son is there. I mean, is that what you say?
Maybe it was her way of saying remember.
I think it was her way of, she was very cool. And she was distant, and she was dying of cirrhosis. Emotions were not her strong suit. And I really, so I did, I grew up the child of an alcoholic, and who was a kind of an alcoholic who was rather normal in the day, and then at night morphed. It was very Jekyll and Hyde and very scary, because who was my mother? The day mother or the night mother?
Right.
And there was, I just used that take notes things as a taking off point to really talk about in a really honest way, what it is to grow up that child in that home and trying to understand who my mother was, which, by the way, I really don't know. And it was the hardest piece to write. It kept me up nights. And the thing that I do when something's really difficult, I try to get at what I'm feeling and write it right so that I'm not thinking about how much I'm opening my veins. It's like this, the writing protects
right.
me, but I really wanted it to be as honest as it could be.
Well, your sisters and you all have taken notes.
Yes, of course. And it is the way that gets you through. I mean, that's the irony, isn't it? I mean, I don't take notes. No, I do not. I write about things later to help me understand them and to get me to a better place.
Well, it sounds like this collection is really all about that. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
That was Delia Affron talking about her new book, Sister, Mother, Husband, Dog.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering listeners of this podcast a free audiobook when you try Audible free for 30 days. One audiobook to consider is the 2013 Hugo Award-winning novel Red Shirts, a novel with three codas, by John Scalzi. That's Red Shirts, and it's available on Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview. That's audible.com/bookreview.
Eric Schlosser joins us now to talk about his new book, Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety. Hi, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
So I was trying to draw a line between your three books in my head. Fast Food Nation, I thought, well, that's about something that we don't think of as being dangerous, but actually is. And then Reefer Madness, which was in part about marijuana, something that we maybe thought was dangerous, but turns out maybe isn't. And then nuclear weapons, something that we obviously know is dangerous, but maybe we don't fully understand all the ways in which it's dangerous.
Those are pretty good summaries of the book. And in the case of nuclear weapons, it's something that I think has been off the national radar for years now and hasn't been discussed in the mainstream as much as I think it should be. And the other thing that links the three books maybe is official secrecy about the truth and the effort to manage public opinion and kind of keep the mainstream away from some very disturbing realities.
A lot of the research that you did for this book was from previously classified papers. Tell me about the process of getting at this information, and when did all this research become available?
It was really tough. I thought I could finish the book in 2 years. It wound up taking six. Some of that was just the complexity of the material and trying to understand it myself and then explain it clearly. Some of it was I did Freedom of Information Act requests that took two and a half years to get a response from the government. And as would be expected, it was very difficult to get people to talk about this subject. Nuclear weapons are, I believe, the greatest national security threat that the United States faces. It's a legitimate national security threat. So there is a need for some secrecy, but again and again I would find that things that were being kept secret were really being kept secret to help the government avoid embarrassment and not because of revelation of this information would somehow endanger us. So it was a real challenge.
When people hear Damascus, especially today, they think automatically, well, Syria. But obviously, this was actually in Arkansas. Can you tell us about what this Damascus accident was?
Yeah, and it's how I got started on this project. I was spending time with the Air Force. After I wrote Fast Food Nation, I was looking for something else to write. And an Air Force officer told me about this accident involving a nuclear weapon in Damascus, Arkansas. And the story just seemed so extraordinary to me that I just felt I had to write about it someday. In Damascus, Arkansas, there was a missile silo with an intercontinental ballistic missile that had the most powerful warhead on it that's ever been put on an American missile. And during a routine maintenance procedure, someone who was working in the silo dropped a tool. A socket came off a wrench. The tool fell down the silo about 80 feet, 90 feet, and bounced, hit the missile, pierced the skin of the missile, and caused a fuel leak. And from that point on, there was a very urgent effort to figure out how to prevent the missile from exploding, because this warhead on top of it was, you know, a hydrogen bomb, essentially, that was more powerful than, you know, all the weapons, all the bombs used during the Second World War, including both atomic bombs. So I started out trying to write a very straightforward sort of thriller, but a sort of techno-thriller in which nothing really works. But then the more I dug into it, the more I learned about safety problems with our nuclear weapons, and the story just got bigger and bigger and in many ways more disturbing to me.
And when did this happen in Arkansas?
It happened in September of 1980. So we're just about, it wasn't planned this way, but the publication date of the book is just about the same date as the anniversary of this accident.
And it turns out this was not an isolated incident, right? You describe a number of accidents that have taken place over the course of the Cold War.
There were quite a few of them, and I did my best to dig them up and get accurate information on them. And I have no doubt whatsoever there were many more accidents that I didn't find that were serious. These nuclear weapons are complex machines, and they go wrong like every other man-made machine. But the consequences of a nuclear weapon going wrong are almost unimaginable. I mean, you know, we had Fukushima a few years ago and Chernobyl, and the accidental detonation of one of our nuclear weapons would be far more serious than either one of those. Now, the book isn't just an attack on the government, because I tried at length to talk about the heroism and the patriotism of many of the people working in this system, desperately trying to avoid catastrophes and putting their lives at risk often to prevent an accidental detonation. And particularly during the Cold War, these nuclear weapons did serve as a deterrent for the Soviet Union overrunning Western Europe. I do believe that if the United States did not have nuclear weapons after the Second World War, I don't know that the Red Army would have gone across Germany and France, but I do think Western Europe and the United Kingdom would have fallen into the Soviet bloc. So it's a complex story, and I've tried to tell it in a way that doesn't demonize anybody and lets the facts speak for themselves. And for me, these were pretty unsettling facts to learn.
When you talk about how complicated the machinery is, it brought to mind in his book, The World Without Us, Alan Weisberg talks about, you know, in general, what would happen to the planet if people weren't here. And one of the things he talks about are nuclear power plants. It's not nuclear weaponry, but nuclear power plants, if left untended, sort of, you know, just how quickly things would go very wrong.
Yeah.
How much maintenance does all of this weaponry and these systems require? And, you know, what are the possibilities?
The weapon systems themselves, the missiles, the bombers that carry the bombs, the submarines, today, those are the things that require the constant vigilance and maintenance, particularly because we have a nuclear war fighting strategy that requires our missiles to be launched almost on a moment's notice. And it's very, very difficult to keep this technology ready to go, you know, at the snap of a finger, at the same time completely safe. And one of the things I write about in the book is the inherent contradiction between the always having our weapons always ready to be used at a moment's notice and the never, which is that they never would be detonated by mistake, by accident, or used by someone who didn't have proper authorizations. And it's this conflict between always and never which makes it very, very challenging and difficult to control this weaponry. And plus the fact, as I said earlier, they're very complex machines. If you look at the weapons as machines, and they're also the most dangerous weapons ever invented.
So you talk about in the book all the vigilance this requires on our part of maintaining this, but then the frightening question is, well, what's going on in Russia or China or Pakistan where perhaps they aren't able to maintain quite the same level of vigilance?
It's very worrisome. You know, my book is a long book looking at the problems with the management of our own nuclear weapons. And the United States invented this technology. We perfected it. I'll be patriotic and jingoistic for a second. I bet we build the best, safest nuclear weapons in the world. And yet, if we've had these serious problems, think about Pakistan, think about India, Russia. And one of the things I do at the end of the book is I try to look at the level of industrial accidents, the rate of industrial accidents in other countries, as a measure of their ability to manage complex technologies. And we should be very concerned about these other countries and their ability to control their own nuclear weapons. The latest threat that is almost unbelievable and out of a terrible crap Hollywood movie is the possibility of our nuclear command and control system being hacked. And it seems like, you know, it's a ridiculous and fantastic scenario, but the government is concerned about it. And there's now a good deal of money being spent to search for the vulnerabilities in our system that might let someone get into the system, either disable our weapons or launch one of our missiles without authorization.
How realistic a threat is that?
I don't think it's going to happen tomorrow afternoon at 3, but one of the disturbing things that the Snowden case has shown is the threat might be from someone within the system. And we're talking about very complex software. I'm not predicting this is going to happen, but it's just one more way that having these very dangerous weapons might endanger ourselves.
Are people in general sort of scared of the right things? Do we know what it is that's the most worrisome thing?
You know, in an immediate sense, the thing that's probably going to endanger you most is driving to work on the freeway, where statistically you're most likely to have a really bad problem. And I didn't write this book to make people afraid or make people, you know, lie in bed at night worried about their nuclear weapons. I wrote the book to create an awareness and to hopefully provoke a discussion and, in a simple sense, just tell a good story. The problems I discuss in this book are not inevitable. I don't believe that we're doomed. But I think of all the national security issues we should be discussing, nuclear weapons is at the top. And for most of our history, our policies on nuclear weapons have been made by a small group of officials in Washington with very little public knowledge or oversight. And I think this subject is too important to leave to a small group of people to make these decisions in secret. So what I'm hoping for is not to terrify readers, but to provoke them to think about this subject. We can absolutely change the policies that we currently have in place.
All right. Well, I can't help feel a little bit scared listening to all that. But thank you, Eric. The book is Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, The Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety by Eric Schlosser. Eric, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's on the list this week?
Before I jump into the hardcover bestsellers, I just wanted to buzz quickly over to the trade paperback list, the trade fiction list, to note that 10 of the 20 titles are by foreign authors this week, fully half of them. Largely, that's because E.L. James of 50 Shades of Grey owns 3 of those 10 titles. And also J.K. Rowling and Paulo Coelho are regulars on the list.
Well, that makes sense, given that the Man Booker Prize shortlist appeared this week. We are going global.
Yeah, a lot of overlap there. Well, maybe not overlap, but a lot of non-Americans on the American trade paperback list.
All right. Are we all American on the hardcover list?
No, we are not all American on the hardcover list. At the top, at number one, the British thriller writer Lee Child has his latest Jack Reacher novel on the list. That's called Never Go Back, and it's new at number one. At number two, Clive Cussler, with his co-writer Thomas Perry, has a book called The Mayan Secrets. Then at number four, Sherilyn Kenyon, who writes these paranormal romances, has a book as part of her Dark Hunter series called Styx that makes its debut at number four.
That's double X Styx.
S-T-Y-X-X, yes, as in the river Styx. Then at number six, another paranormal romance, not the Dark Hunter series, but the Dark series by Christine Feehan. That book is called Dark Lichen. And at number eight, another non-American, the Canadian Margaret Atwood. Her latest book is called Mad Adam. It is the third book of her apocalyptic trilogy. The first two were Oryx and Crake and Year of the Flood. They were both bestsellers as well. And then down at number 16, a debut novelist, 35-year-old Jason Mott out of North Carolina, has a novel called The Returned. And this is a look at the lives of a couple whose 8-year-old son shows up at their door one day 50 years after he drowned. It's getting some comparisons to like Tom Perrotta's The Leftovers. It's sort of a realistic domestic look at what may be a religious miracle or the sign of the end times.
A realistic sign of the end times.
There you go.
Okay.
Over on the nonfiction side of things, there are just three new titles, including, again, the number one hardcover title on the nonfiction side of things is a new book. That book is Psychology One. It's a pun. Psy is S-I-cology. It's by Cy Robertson with Mark Schlabach. Cy Robertson is a member of the Duck Commander family from the reality show.
Their ongoing domination of the bestseller list.
Boy, they just own the hardcover nonfiction list right now. Then at number six, the book Salinger by David Shields and Shane Salerno. This is an oral history, and it is being published as the official accompaniment to the documentary Salinger that's also out right now.
Review proof.
And then at number 14, the last new title on the hardcover nonfiction list this week is Amanda Ripley's The Smartest Kids in the World. We reviewed that book in our back-to-school issue.
That was our cover.
That's exactly right. This is her look at how kids perform in schools in other countries, how their educational systems work and maybe work better than the American educational system.
Well, I guess it's a good time to figure that out.
It's never a bad time to figure that out.
All right. Well, thank you, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.